Chapter 2. Target, Parthmal. Moreland City. The Hetman meeting that followed the Battle of Moreland City ended with the sun just touching the western mountains. Wellman Stent, the Hetman of Clan Stent, stood outside the stone meeting building alongside Hetman Adris and Huel, while the Stent and Huel clansmen prepared to ride hard for the Narthani supply base at Parthmal, just inside Eyewell province. They would attack the encampment only if they surprised the garrison before it received word of the battle. An hour of light remained, and they planned on covering as many miles as possible before darkness. Since the Stent clan contributed more men to the raid than Huel did, by agreement, Hetman Stent would lead the raid. Four other clans, Adris, Bolteki, Oros, and Pewit, would harass the withdrawing Narthani army, picking off individuals and patrols and setting traps and ambushes until the Narthani crossed into more secure Eyewell territory. None of the six clans was to engage the Narthani in battle. Although the clansmen were mounted and thus more mobile than the Narthani, the clans would be no match for the formidable Narthani infantry and artillery in a direct confrontation.
"The three of us saw firsthand what the Narthani are capable of," said Klingo Adris, shaking his head. "It will take the Moreland clan a generation or more to recover from the number of their men killed in only a few minutes."
"Aye," agreed Lordum Huel. "Which is why all of us need to be cautious and audacious at the same time. Especially you, Stent, as we ride for Parthmal. I've agreed to let you lead this raid because someone has to, and more of your clansmen will go than mine. But only as long as I don't see Huel men wasted to no purpose."
Huel's statement didn't offend Stent. He would have said the same in the Huel Hetman's position. Coordination among clans was critical to resist the Narthani, but his own clan's people came first.
"We'll push to get ahead of the Narthani, while the other clans harass and slow them," said Stent. "Then look to take Parthmal only if we catch them unawares. If not, we'll circle back and help snipe at the Narthani army. I might also send scouts on toward Hanslow, depending on what happens at Parthmal."
Lowering his voice and stepping closer to the others, Stent switched to first names.
"Lordum, Klingo, what do you think of this Joseph Kolsko from Keelan? I've heard reports and know of some of the innovations he's brought to Cadellium, but your two clans are joining the Tri-Clan Alliance. Do you know more about him?"
Lordum Huel shook his head.
"Probably most of what you've already heard, except that College Keelan thinks highly of him. Enough so he's let Kolsko marry his eldest daughter."
"Mara," said Stent. "I've only seen her a couple of times, but I hear the stories."
"Whatever you heard is probably true," said Adris, laughing. "She'd be a handful for any man. Smart as can be, with a tongue that can flay at 100 feet. I know that suitors have come and gone for several years, either not wanting her for a wife, no matter the advantages of a marriage linked to Keelan, or her running them off at the first meeting."
"I think she's pictured unfairly," said Huel. "I've met her a few more times than Klingo and found her extremely honest, possibly to a fault. She's certainly got a mind of her own. And I've heard that scholastics within Keelan think she could have been a scholastic of the highest order if she hadn't been a Keelan Hetman's daughter."
"So I wonder even more about her marrying this Kolsko," said Stent. "College Keelan is as canny as they come, so he must see a major advantage to the clan to approve the wedding."
"Pardon,"
said Kadok Gwilymer as he walked up to the threesome.
"I couldn't help overhearing. You're wondering about Joseph Kolsko?"
"Yes, Kadok," said Huel. "You're part of the Tri-Clan Alliance. What do you know about Kolsko?"
"I've met him once, and I've talked with and exchanged letters with College. He's mentioned Kolsko many times. At first it was just casual comments, but then, during the last months, it's been obvious Koska was important in Kulch's thinking and planning.
What of these rumors he washed up on Cadellium a few years ago? Asked Adris.
That's what Kulch told me, and I wasn't sure what to believe.
That seems to be true, said Gwilymer. Kulch told me the same story. Plus, in Gwilymer, we've heard the tale from other sources, including some who live in the Abbotsford area. They found Koska on a beach, naked, and not speaking Cadelli. I've also heard some people believe he didn't wash in from the sea, and that somehow he was placed on the beach.
Placed? Queried Stent. What does that mean?
My God, mumbled Huel,
in a tone that got the other men looking at him.
That would go with another rumor I've heard, and one I'd discounted as fanciful.
Huel looked around as if to check whether anyone outside their foursome stood within hearing distance.
Septosh, he whispered. What?
Exclaimed Stent, who also looked around and lowered his voice.
Are you serious? Some people consider this Koska to be a Septosh? An agent of God?
I know, said Gwilymer. I've heard the same rumor. Though I'm not subscribing to it myself. But you have to wonder. Koska arrived in Keelan only a few years ago, and now has introduced new products that are making him exceedingly wealthy, has married the Keelan Hetman's oldest daughter, and is obviously important in our struggle against the Narthani. I don't know if you've all heard the stories about the Buldorian raid on St. Sidran's Abbey on Keelan's southern coast.
Adris and Stent shook their heads, but Huel nodded and spoke.
Kulch told me a little of it one evening over ales, but no details.
I know more, said Gwilymer. St. Sidran's isn't too far from my clan's border with Keelan, and there's regular travel and trade. Plus, Kulch came to their western town of Dornfeld some months back. Dornfeld sits on the Gwilymer-Keelan border. The Narthani and the Iwali seem to threaten an attack on that part of Keelan province and might push on into Gwilymer. Kulch came with advisors to Dornfeld, and I met him there. We discussed what response to make. The evening before all of us met, Kulch and I talked, and he mentioned bringing Koska along to see if the man might have any useful suggestions. That's when he told me details of the Buldorian attack on St. Sidran's Abbey. Evidently, the Keelanders saw no way to stop the Buldorians until Koska suggested a tactic, one that was successful in repelling the raiders with major losses, compared to relatively few casualties for the Keelanders.
Now this Koska was instrumental in our victory over the Narthani, said Stent, running a hand over his shaven head. I don't think there's any doubt things might have turned out much worse today if it wasn't for Kolsko's analysis of the situation and suggestions for attacking the Narthani flank.
And none of you have seen for yourselves up close the effect of artillery, said Gwilymer. I know you saw what happened to the Moorlanders slaughtered by the Narthani muskets and cannon, but my clansmen and I were nearby when those odd artillery pieces of Kolsko's first fired at the end block of Narthani infantry. When that block was destroyed, Keelan and Gwilymer horsemen overran the nearby Narthani cannon, and I saw Koska turning the Narthani's own cannon on the next infantry blocks.
No, asserted Gwilymer. There's no doubt that whoever this Koska is, and wherever he came from, he's been a godsend to us all. And I believe we need to pay close attention to anything he says.
I'll have to meet him myself, said Stent. I'm sure there'll be an all-clan conclave as soon as the Narthani have returned to Iwal province and don't appear to be contemplating another invasion too soon. We need to be sure Kulch brings this Koska to the conclave.
I agree, said Huel.
But for now, three of us need to get back to our men. They should be ready to ride by now. Stanton and I need to reach Parthmoor before the garrison gets word of what happened here today.
And you, Caddick, you get back to your province, said Stent. The Triclan Alliance has done the most to turn back the Narthanian, has taken the most casualties, except for the Moorlanders. Get your men home and back to their families. I only hope the rest of us can do the same soon.
The four men took turns clasping forearms or hands, the customs varied among clans, and rode off in two directions. Caddick Gwilymer to rejoin his men and head south toward home, and the other three hetmen to gather their men in an attempt to strike more blows against the Narthani. Parthmal, Iwal Province. One day later, in the middle of the night, Wellman Stent, Lordum Hewell, and a dozen of their senior men crowded into a makeshift shelter of blankets and hides held up by clansmen. The men pressed together around a small fire that reflected off their faces. They had pushed their horses as hard as they dared. Plus, Stent had sent 100 men with extra horses riding even harder to maneuver themselves in advance of the Narthani forces' line of march, with the purpose of preventing messengers from reaching Parthmal. The main Stent and Hewell force had passed south of the Narthani army the previous afternoon, but they didn't know whether word had reached Parthmal about Moreland City.
Men sent ahead confirm earlier reports about the Narthani encampment, said Stent, his face grim but determined, his shaved head hidden by a leather helm with inlaid iron strips that reflected the firelight. It's just east of the village of Parthmal. The village has no obvious defenses, but the encampment has a 6-foot-high earthen berm 300 yards on the side, with 20-foot towers on the corners and midway between the corners. Under each tower is a cannon, though our men couldn't see if these were manned. At least two of the tower platforms must have fires within them, since our men could see light and the outlines of men. Maybe four more men in each tower. There also must be firing positions on the inside of the berm, since they saw a few men's heads and shoulders outlined against lights within the encampment. However, they're likely just individuals standing in position instead of a continuous rampart, since those men never move from the few places where they were seen. There's a single opening in the berm on the western side, with a wooden gate attached to tree trunks sunk into the ground. We assume the gate will be closed and barred.
And no sign of any watchmen outside of the encampment or moving patrols? Asked a grizzled clansman.
None they saw. But we need to be aware that our men could have missed them. That's why we'll start the attack only when we're all in position and there's no sign that the Narthani are on alert. We know what can happen to men attacking a Narthani position that's ready for it. So if there's any sign they're expecting us, we'll abort the attack.
Stent turned to face a lanky, black-bearded clansman.
Wim, you have a critical task and the most dangerous. I don't want to commit everyone to the attack unless we think we've surprised them and can breach the berm. Once you commit, your 100 men will ride for the part of the berm between the southeast corner and the adjacent tower in the middle of the south berm. You have 10 men carrying shielded lanterns. Once they reach the top of the berm and see that they can ride down the other side, they're to uncover the lanterns and drop them on top of the berm. We'll assume that if they survive to reach the top, then they've surprised the Narthani. Another 700 men will wait until they see the signal and then follow. 800 of our men inside the encampment are about all the area will hold, and the rest of the men will stay outside in case they're needed.
Wim Terrell's solemn expression conveyed he knew his and his men's fate if the Narthani were waiting, but he nodded.
We'll do our best to open the way. We're only lucky the Narthani evidently didn't want to dig too deep. If there was a ditch in front of the berm, we'd never be able to try this.
The soil for the berm had been dug from the adjacent ground. But instead of digging a 3 to 4 foot deep ditch, the builders had taken the easier route and kept to looser soil on the surface. The Stanton Hewell riders would face only a 0.5 to 1 foot drop, about 30 feet wide, before reaching the berm and urging their mounts up the berm slope, hoping their momentum would be sufficient to reach the top. 3 hours later, Wim Terrell peered through a thin screen of trees at the Parthmal encampment. Light provided by the stars and by Hedon, the smaller moon, at half-phase, gave enough light for his acclimated eyes to examine the berm 200 yards away. He estimated it would take them 0.5 minute to reach the berm, starting from a standstill and pushing their horses to a full gallop. 0.5 minute. He wondered, if he were an Arthaniat watch, how long it would take to hear the hoofbeats, see the clansmen coming, register what he saw or heard, give the alarm, and fire whatever weapons were at the ready. 0.5 minute. He looked behind him. 20 yards to either side and stretching back into the brush sat his 100 mounted men. They had walked their horses the final mile, each man with a hand at his mount's muzzle to suppress neighs, all metal tied down or wrapped to minimize sound. No one had spoken a word, not even to whisper. It was time. Terrell climbed onto his horse and signaled to those near him to do the same. Men mounted in a wave stretching to the end of the column. Terrell drew his sword. Another wave passed to the rear as men drew blades. No one carried a musket or a lance, both being too cumbersome to wield in the dark and with horses packed so tight. It would be sword and pistol. Looking back, Terrell saw stars and moonlight reflecting off steel. There could be no hesitation. Any Narthani on watch, if they looked in the right direction, might see a multitude of faint flashes as if fireflies infested the sparse woods. Terrell turned to look ahead and urged his horse forward. After 50 yards, he assumed all of the horses behind him were in motion, and he spurred his mount into a full gallop by 100 yards. No Cadelli spoke, but the sound of 400 hooves arose from a faint rumble to a thunderous roar. Monjak Salomon hated the last watch tour. Since regular duty followed immediately, it made the day seem endless before he could sleep again. Also, he hated his unit's current duty posting, sitting in a forward encampment with few amenities and having to play nice with the Iwilese contingent sharing the post. He hated the Iwilese. Not that he knew many of them, but he was more comfortable with his Narthani compatriots, at least those he came with in the final infantry levy from Narthon. In contrast to his opinion of the islanders, Salomon appreciated the island's weather. Narthon was bone dry with winds and dust, except twice a year, when wind shifts brought drenching rains and suffocating humidity. In contrast, the weather on Cadellium was closer to perfect than an Arthani at home could imagine. Moderate humidity, rain when it came, relatively short-lived compared to week-long seasonal spells at home, constant gentle winds, and daytime temperatures usually varying from a little chill to not quite hot. One of the other men had heard the climate was due to the island's location in global wind patterns and the moderating effect of the surrounding ocean. Salomon glanced up at the eastern horizon, the sky turning a light blue, with pink and yellow tinges on clouds announcing the coming arrival of the sun. Another hour until the night watch would be relieved, and he and the other men could line up for morning meal. Then, as he faced south, something caught his eye. A glint of light off. What? There. Another one. Then more. He squinted and raised a hand to shield his eyes from the lightning sky. There was movement, a waving or rippling of shapes and shadows at the forest edge. He noticed a sound like distant thunder getting closer, but too quickly for a weather system. Suddenly, his eyes made out horses. Horses with riders. Riders holding swords. 10 seconds passed from his first notice until he shouted out an alert and fired his musket at whatever was coming his way. Wim Terrell was one of the 10 men carrying shielded lanterns. 9 of them made it to the top of the berm. A musket round struck 1 lantern carrier. Probably from the first guard to see us, Terrell thought. There had been a flurry of other musket shots, though no cannon and nothing else to stop their charge across the shallow depression formed when the Narthani had dug the berm. The clansmen spurred their mounts up the berm's outer slope and poured over the top. A few horses fell or struggled, but most managed the slope with little problem. At the top, Terrell and the other 8 men uncovered their lanterns and dropped them. A few men on watch were swept away by the tide of horsemen. Of the 100 clansmen in the first group, 88 rode down the inner slope and into the encampment that had just begun to stir. Close behind came 700 riders who had waited for the signal. The attack caught the Narthani and the Iwalese by surprise. In the dark, the clansmen roared through lines of tents and small buildings. They assumed anyone on foot was Narthani or Iwalese, to be cut down with sword or pistol. In the confusion and darkness, no organized resistance was possible as a seemingly endless stream of horsemen surged through the encampment. The clansmen gave no quarter. 20 minutes later, Wellman Stent and Lordam Hewell watched the last of the encampment and the adjacent village of Parthmal's buildings added to the conflagration. The light from fires was bright enough to read small print or identify the hair color and the beard length on scattered bodies.
"I think we've done all the damage we can do here," said Hewell. "Right," said Stent. "I'm tempted to go farther, but prudence says we take this victory and get back to safer territory. However, I think I'll send a few dozen men to scout toward Hanslow. As for the rest of us, let's gather up whatever firearms we find and see if we can hitch up the Narthani cannon to those small wagons we've seen them use. Then we'll go directly east, sending scouts well ahead to find the Narthani army and the clans harassing them. Once we find the other clans, we'll assess whether we're needed, or can head back to Moreland City."